Are you resident? Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well.
Thank you. Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, may it please the court, this is an appeal from a trial, a jury trial, where my client, Delmarva Power & Light Company, would respectfully request this court to consider not only the very specific issues raised in the briefing and the notice of appeal, but to consider those issues in totality. As this court held in the Roblin versus DeFonso case, this court must consider both individual errors and the collective nature of the errors and abuses of discretion in a jury trial, such as the Bounds case that we're here about today. Whether the conduct of plaintiff's counsel before the court and the jury with little meaningful remedial action by the trial judge, even when error was found or acknowledged, the trial court's failure to follow the standards of DURE 407 regarding subsequent remedial measures, the trial court's failure to follow holdings of this court regarding evidence of unrelated locations in the multi-acre Indian River Power Plant, in the court's denial as a matter of law of Delmarva's superseding cause defense in permitting the comp carrier to simply thwart the Delmarva GEICO contract after initially agreeing to waive the lien that was present pursuant to contract. Collectively and individually, these abuses of discretion and errors of law require reversal and a new trial. Delmarva acknowledges the substantial latitude that is given to the trial judge. However, that discretion has limits, and those limits were exceeded in this instance. Delmarva would be pleased to review any particular individual issues, but we'll start argument with regard to the conduct of counsel in the opening and the remaining phases of the trial, as well as the size of the verdict as compared to the evidence. In this particular case, the verdicts, $1.5 million for Mr. Bounds and $275,000 for Mrs. Bounds, were simply beyond the maximum of what a reasonable jury could find based on the evidence as a whole, including a consideration of the uncontested evidence of plaintiff's economist, Dr. Minahan, which was acknowledged by the trial judge in his opinion denying the motions for post-trial relief by Delmarva as being an amount in the vicinity of $200,000. This was a slip-and-fall case where the evidence of record, even when considered by a reasonable jury, simply wouldn't support verdicts of that size. There was no claim for future medical expenses presented. Past medical expenses were limited to $10,000, and the actual economic loss was in the range of $200,000 to $250,000 based on Dr. Minahan's testimony and the duty of the plaintiff to mitigate. This was a case where the plaintiff, at the time of trial, had been released from all medical treatment by his doctors. In addition to that, had been cleared to return to work either on a light duty or medium duty basis, depending on which of the doctors testified. His own doctors testified that at best he would require future surgery in the distant future on a 50-50 basis, according to Dr. DeShuttle, and the other doctor, Dr. Trauger, who was from Salisbury, testified he could not estimate a time in the future where any kind of knee replacement surgery might be required.
The thrust of his argument is the verdict is too high, and my question to you is, what's our standard of review in reviewing that, and what's the leading case that supports your position?
Your Honor, I think one of the cases is the Lacey versus Beck opinion by President Judge Siftel, which was recognized by this court in subsequent decisions on a number of occasions, where, among other things, the court is supposed to look also at comparable verdicts, not simply disregard whatever else has happened. And I've presented a number of cases, Your Honor, where motions for a new trial were remitted or were granted, particularly in the Kent County Superior Court over the number of years that were involved, such as the Clow versus Walmart case. The others are cited in the brief, the Patinero decision and a number of the others, where in a case with very similar types of injuries to this one, the verdicts that were sustained were in the, at most, $450,000 to $500,000 range after careful scrutiny by the trial courts in those cases.
The question, yes, sir, I believe that Justice Holland asked was, what is the standard?
It's an abuse of discretion standard, Your Honor, and that was acknowledged by both sides. But as part of the abuse of discretion standard, the court is the trial court was required to look at comparable verdicts, which it declined to do in its opinion. In addition, it did not make an overall decision as was required, again, in Lacey versus Beck or Stewart versus Genesco, as to what the maximum evidence that the evidence could sustain here.
This argument, in some cases, could be a discrete standalone argument, and I understand you're identifying it as such in this part of your argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
But in your brief, you then relate it to the conduct of counsel.
Yes, both these are standalone grounds, but in this case, we're contending that both were present.
So the corollary argument, I guess, or the related argument is, not only should the verdict have been examined independently and reduced, but we can attribute the size of the verdict to the conduct of the plaintiff's counsel.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, an abuse of discretion standard is applicable there as well. This court has taken a more and more firm approach, starting with the DeAngelis case, which built on earlier decisions of this court in Dixon versus Delaware Olds, McNally versus Ekman, and the Wells versus Massey Ferguson. I'm sorry, there were two appeals there, and I always get which one covered the conduct of counsel confused. But in all those cases, they have now presented a whole catalog of conduct by counsel. And in this case, as we pointed out in our brief, this occurred throughout the trial before the jury with no meaningful remedies by the court. We also presented, there were times, and I've admitted that in our briefs, where we did not object after having objections denied or no action taken by the court. As we put it in the briefing, that we were presented with a Hobson's choice after time of further increasing the prejudice. At one point, we were told by the judge, will simply go ahead and interrupt counsel's questioning. There's a judgment that you have to make at some point that's going to compound the error even more. And I think we made a record in detail on that. Excuse me, Your Honor.
Let me just make sure I understand your legal position on this verdict
yes.
issue. Everybody agrees that the standard of review is abuse of discretion.
Yes.
Your contention is that it is an abuse of discretion if the award exceeds the maximum that would be permitted under any view of the evidence.
That's one of the parts of the
analysis. It's an abuse of discretion if the court does not, in considering a motion to remit or for a new trial, to consider comparable verdicts.
That's correct, I think, under the Lacey versus Beck analysis.
Those are the two errors.
There's a third, which is what's in the DeAngelis versus Harmon case, which is if the court is an abuse of discretion, if during the trial or in post-trial motions, the court does not take firm action to remedy actions of created by counsel's conduct during the course of the trial.
Are these independent standalone grounds?
Yes. I believe that the decisions of this court are quite clear on that subject.
But the second ground is your assertion that your client didn't get a fair trial because the jury wasn't properly instructed about the conduct of counsel and the trial judge didn't take remedial action to prevent it from continuing throughout the trial.
That's our position, Your Honor, and that's what this court recognized in the DeAngelis v. Harmon case, that there had to be not just action by the court, but firm remedial action, which could include an instruction, could include other action created by the court.
But what are you explaining the court's rulings that certain conduct was improper, and then its failure to give an instruction to the jury or to prevent it from recurring? Because that's what the record reflects. The judge would make these rulings that says, don't do that, and then it would recur, and the judge would say, well, don't do that again, and
I asked for relief over and over again during the course of the trial. I mean, this wasn't a small or isolated incident. Your Honor has picked up on what does appear in the record with regard to that, that we asked repeatedly for cautions, for admonitions, for some type of additional conduct. We asked for a standing objection. We asked the counsel be instructed to cease the conduct, yet it continued throughout the 7 days, primarily with the plaintiff's testimony and then with the questioning of the Delmarva primarily expert witnesses.
Was the same judge that presided over the proceeding that resulted in the mistrial?
Yes. That occurred 1 week before this trial occurred. Significantly, Your Honor, again, with regard to that conduct, and I just want to focus one more part of this issue, specifically in the summation, right at the opening of the summation, there was a very dramatic presentation about the length and the cost of the trial. And although the court says that there was confusion, I specifically, and it's clear, I believe in the record, asked for a cautionary. A cautionary is the term that, as I understand it, is the type of instruction to be requested with some kind of admonition to the jury. I was under the impression it was going to be granted. I sat down, but the court took no additional action. And again, the Hobson's choice position that the counsel has put in at that point of either going off after you've thought you have an affirmative ruling by the court and then no action is taken, we believe led to the type of verdict that was done and awarded in behalf of Mr. Bounds in this particular case. I want to turn, if I could now, to the second issue, which is the Rule 407 issue. Again, an abuse of discretion standard is applicable. However, in ruling on the abuse of discretion, the appellate courts that looked at this have said specifically that the court is to have narrow focused exceptions to Rule 407. In this particular case, none of those exceptions were followed. There wasn't an issue of control, feasibility of remedial measures, impeachment, or anything else. Delmar very carefully moved for relief prior to the trial. The proffer that was given by plaintiff's counsel was that the evidence was being offered to show the jury what the situation is so they can understand the case. At the trial itself, in the opening, counsel stated, and it's quoted in our brief, the liability part of this case, where you heard Judge Vaughn tell you that this area has been modified. It was a total different position from what was taken in the argument on the motion in limine. This was after the first mistrial, and
help me understand the record that led up to the ruling, because it appears that at one time the plaintiff couldn't locate the exact area where he fell,
mm-hmm.
and that was because there had been a change in the area.
Right.
And then the judge wanted the jury to understand what was going on. There seemed to be some concern that you were going to be making the argument if he couldn't find the area where he fell, then he didn't fall or he didn't know where he fell, and that it was fair to say that it had changed. Did you ever agree that you weren't going to use his inability to locate the area against him?
That representation was made to the court in the argument in the motion in limine before trial. What was done in the trial was after the court had ruled that this evidence was admissible. At that point, the court ruled and we had to follow what the court's ruling was.
So if we reread the motion in limine, we'll find in there that you were content if there was no evidence of the remedial action, you weren't going to try to capitalize on the fact the plaintiff couldn't find the area where he fell.
That's correct. There were 8 witnesses who could testify as to the condition of the drain cap prior to the incident where this fall occurred, as well as we had a two-dimensional drawing without the vertical plane, which was the issue as to what the height of the particular cap was in this case, which I believe the range in witness testimony actually was anywhere from a quarter of an inch to one witness said 4 inches above the ground. That was something for the jury to consider. But none of this was Delmarva's fault in the sense that there were no pictures taken at the time of the incident because Mr. Bounds did not report that he was injured. My client was simply advised that there had been a problem with a worker. They fixed the area after having that advice, but there was no investigation done, there were no photographs taken or anything such as that done. So it wasn't as though Delmarva did something to hide the condition or anything like that on an affirmative basis. They weren't even aware that there had been an injury such as this in this particular instance. I will rely on the case law and the briefs. I also think that that's important for the court to consider, especially the interpretations of the federal circuits on this particular issue. It doesn't seem to have gotten much treatment since Rule 407 was adopted by this court, or for that matter, the other courts in Delaware. However, it has gotten detailed treatment in the circuit courts. With regard to the next issue, which is the issue with the other caps, again, I would commend the court to what this court has required in the Jewell case and also the Cowie versus Wilmington Country Club case in terms of the proper, that there has to be a substantial similarity with the conditions complained of. There wasn't anything like that, despite the fact that there had been an in limine request outside the hearing of the jury to a requirement that something like that be established. It wasn't done. And again, the language of the court's decision is in there. Finally, and again, time limits, but I wanted to focus on the issue with regard to the denial of the superseding cause defense. This court in DeFilly clearly said that that kind of an issue is an issue that's an issue of law, not, this is the one area where there's a different standard of review. It's not something that's customarily resolved as a matter of law by the trial courts. In this case, there was very little reasoning given, and I quoted again the court's rulings.
Well,
in our briefs,
the issue is whether the act that's claimed to constitute a superseding cause must be tortious. Is that right?
Excuse me.
Isn't the issue whether the conduct that is claimed to be a superseding cause must be tortious in character as opposed to contractual?
No, I don't think it is. I think if you look, and we cited to the court to section 457 of the restatement, what it said was that that conduct has to be extraordinary and something that couldn't reasonably be predicted by the tortfeasor. In this particular case, Delmarva indirectly paid, excuse me.
Whether it's contractual or tortious.
Yes.
And you're claiming that that it is extraordinary and not foreseeable that a carrier may decline to pay workers' comp?
It's not simply decline, Your Honor. It's decline without any basis, which this court in the Pierce case and the Brown versus Liberty Mutual case has recognized to be an act of bad faith, which can serve as a basis against the comp carrier for a claim and for action in the Superior Court. That's been held by this court on several occasions now since 1996.
Well, there are cases where insurers have been sanctioned under a bad faith theory. But is there any case that you cite in your brief that holds that a bad faith refusal by the insurer to pay workers' comp constitutes a superseding cause?
I will candidly concede that there's not. The restatement language, I think, is the key. And if the court were to look at comment D in section 457, which again is quoted in our brief, it looks to the standard of extraordinary conduct, not tortious conduct. There's no reference actually in that comment to tortious conduct. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for reply.
Very well.
Please, the court. I'm going to make a few comments on things that TPNL's counsel then said and sort of rebuttal, then I'll go to my prepared statement. Dealing with the summation, which is the point that he made, it is there that I made some reference to the relative size of the parties, and an objection was sustained. There was an argument about it. By the way, that was the only objection they made during my summation. It's unclear, but Judge Vaughn sustained the objection, and DP&L didn't ask for a curative instruction. It was cut off. They asked for a cautionary. They were cut off again. Cautionaries go to lawyers. Curative instructions go to jurors, and nothing was requested by DP&L to be told to the jury. I didn't mention that particular point anymore, and went on. And so it doesn't seem to me that there's any basis for an appeal point on that point. Whatever was there, Judge Vaughn dealt with. He gave whatever relief Mr. Price requested and no more. So far as the opening, where he cites a little snippet of my opening statement where I say, turning to liability or so far as liability, all the years I've been doing summations and openings, I divide and my summations this way, by the way. If you look at that, it starts with general comments, then liability, then damages. And in my opening, I had some general comments and then turned to liability. And one of the issues I met by liability, I just met the whole "are we entitled to recover" scheme. And then and as part of that, I said, by the way, I need to tell you the scene's been modified. There was no objection made. because it wasn't objectionable. It was a lead-in. And I wasn't saying that that necessarily had anything. It had something to do with how the accident happened and how it was going to be conveyed to the jury. But it was part of what we have to prove to get a verdict, as opposed to the final part was what should the verdict be if we do get one. And that's the answer to that. So far as the thing about DP&L not agreeing to say that if the jury was not told about modification, that then DP&L would not try to cross-examine Bounds about what happened in the fall of 2001 when he went back with counsel. I wasn't there, but other people from my office, Mr. Price was there, and he walked out of the elevator where he fell and realized he'd only been there one prior time in his life. That was in April of 2000. He walked out, they all looked at him. He looked around, he walked 80 feet, 90 feet, he couldn't find the thing over which he fell. It turns out DP&L's counsel had instructed the GEICO people, don't say anything, don't tell him, don't let him know it's been changed, and he was confused. And they raised that in the pretrial, they were going to raise that at trial, and that's one of the reasons that Judge Vaughn made the ruling he did on 407. I mean, number two,
saying that Mr. Price is wrong, if we read the motion in limine, we won't find a representation from Mr. Price that they wouldn't try to capitalize on his inability to locate where he fell.
I have to admit, I haven't read that carefully in preparation of this argument. If it was in there, that wasn't the position that he took in the court in the terms of the argument, and that is a matter of record. It wasn't what he took in terms of the pretrial conference. And in fact, he did still make that argument at trial that Bounds didn't know where he fell, so maybe he really didn't fall.
Well, but we've kind of compartmentalized the way we examine it. After a court's ruled, everybody regroups on their position. What we need to focus on is what was before the judge when the judge decided to put in evidence that the accident scene had been changed.
Well, what was before the judge was the fact that it was just going to be impossible to convey this case to the jury without allowing them to know that it had been modified, because otherwise, as Judge Vaughn said in the comments he made later in the trial where he sort of reaffirmed his ruling, he said, it would have left a hole in the case. I think that was the main reason. And he didn't, in his discretion, decided that the jury needed the entire picture. But he, not once, but twice, at the beginning of the trial and at the end of the trial, instructed them that the modification was not evidence of negligence and they should not consider that as such. It was brought in to give them the big picture.
Right, now, given that focus on the specific area of the accident, let's move to why it was proper in a building with, a great many stories and a great many other cats to present that evidence. Why is that helpful rather than confusing?
Well, in the first place, on that point, the witness had testified, and that witness was Mr. Davis, had testified at deposition that there were other caps and that they extended up more than a half inch. And when I asked him about that at trial, he first denied it. And then, so actually, he could have been forced to answer that question just on the basis of impeachment. But Judge Vaughn went further and said, there are other caps, and they're saying that they're all supposed to be a certain height. The fact that they have other caps that are a half inch, three quarters of an inch, it could be relevant. They came back and then countered that by saying, okay, they have these other caps, but they're not in walking lanes. Well, okay, that, I suppose, is the answer. But, that developed both at the time of the question and in the follow-up questioning by Mr. Price. But I mean, I view that as the kind of thing that comes up in the course of a trial. A judge makes a ruling on the fly. I think it was right, but I think it was within his discretion. If it was wrong, I don't concede that. I don't think it could be viewed as something that had that much weight that would overturn this entire verdict.
If it was error, it wasn't prejudicial error.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Let me ask you about the size of the verdict argument. There are two propositions that I would like you to address. The first is that under no view of the evidence, this is the argument made by Mr. Price, under no view of the evidence would a $1.5 million verdict be justified. And secondly, that apart from that, that the trial court erred by not considering comparable verdicts. We have another case.
Okay. The way I'd like to deal with that is to answer it this way. Is first, the jury heard this case for 2 weeks. And by common law, constitution, and statute, that's entitled to a lot of weight, their decision. Then Judge Vaughn had a motion for a new trial, which he considered in his discretion, and he ruled that it didn't shock his conscience, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that decision, sitting by Judge Vaughn, is also entitled to great weight. So what you have is, I mean, there was some question about the scope of review of that issue. This court has scope to do anything, but the fact that you have this double presumption, which is that the jury's correct and the trial judge was within in his discretion was correct, it has led to the fact that there are no cases, not in Delaware, nor anywhere in the country that we could find, that have overruled a trial judge where he ruled that a compensatory verdict was not excessive. So that indicates how strong this double presumption is in our law and the law around the country. Now, getting back specifically, Justice Jacobs, to your two points, there's no appellate court authority that talks about you have to apply some standard or you have to decide what the maximum verdict could be. Most of the cases talk about the fact that jury verdicts differ. I mean, I don't know of any case that at the appellate level. Now, there are a lot of Superior Court cases where they say, well, we're going to decide to reduce this because based on other verdicts, we think it exceeds a certain number. Well, that goes to the judge's discretion in the first instance. But once that's exercised, which it was here by Judge Vaughn, I know of no case under either prong of what you were proposing that would allow this court to, well, this court can do anything it wants, but should persuade this court to overrule those two presumptions.
This court really can't do anything it wants. I mean, Article 4, Section 11 of the Constitution is pretty clear that if in a civil appeal from the Superior Court, if the jury's verdict is supported by the evidence, it has to be upheld on appeal. And with regard to new trials, we follow the Camper decision for a long time that talks about abuse of discretion. So both of your points are supported by well-settled law. But that goes into Mr. Price's other point. If, in fact, jury verdicts are not going to be overturned, then the manner in which the trial is conducted is particularly important. And Mr. Price's corollary argument is that the trial judge's inaction with regard to some of Mr. Price's objections that were sustained contributed to an atmosphere that led to a higher verdict.
I dispute that. I mean, the opening brief and the reply brief, I don't want to say it's stream of consciousness, but they say all these things, most of them are without citation, or if you do look at the thing they cite you to, you say, whoa, Elliot didn't say that, or that's taken out of context. We tried to deal with that in our brief. I mean, I'll give you an example. In the reply brief at page 5, they just flat out say that I suggested that the jury put itself in Bounds' place, that I commented on witness credibility based on personal knowledge, not in evidence, and that I vouched for the credibility of Mr. Bounds. There's no cite because it didn't happen. When doing the direct exam of Mr. Bounds, I did lead a little bit. And Judge Vaughn said a couple times, you know, Elliot, I know you're leading. I know you're trying to get through this because it was only obvious things. But, you know, don't lead. And then Mr. Price jumped in during that recess and said, well, I want a cautionary instruction. I don't want him to lead, and I don't want to have to object. And Judge Vaughn said, if he leads, you object. And then he turned to me and said, if you lead and Mr. Price objects and it's disruptive to the progress of the trial, so be it. And that's the way it went forward. There was no Hobson's choice and no continued refusal by Judge Bowen to hear objections. I mean, that's not Judge Bowen's style.
Let me go back for a moment to the two points, and I'll try to simplify it. It's being argued to us that the trial judge had an obligation, a legal duty to compare the verdict that was rendered in this case with comparable verdicts. Is that correct?
No. Absolutely not.
The argument, I think, is that Lacey v. Beck mandates that.
Well, Lacey v. Beck is not a Supreme Court opinion, or if it is, it's not. Nothing in there says that as a matter of law by the Supreme Court. This court has no... I mean, the trial judge has to exercise his judicial discretion. He's the guy who sees the facts, sees the evidence, sees the jury. I mean, I don't see how you could constrain him arbitrarily and say, well, you know, if you have to say, well, ideal verdict would be, in this case, X, and if it goes X plus Y, you have to do a remitter or something. I mean, I don't know of any authority that says that at all, Your Honor.
Secondly, and this is a factual issue that I'd like to get buttoned down, your argument, as I understand it, is that the total blackboard of damages could have been as high as $600,000+, and that $1.5 million is simply three times specials, which is a rule of thumb that's applied by insurance companies. Your view is to a one plausible view of the evidence that would justify the verdict. The response to that is, no, there's nothing in the record that gets you to $600,000+. What is your response?
Well, what is in the record, and it's in the appendix, is A, the testimony of Dr. Minahan, and B, the charts, his actual exhibits are in the record. And he made various assumptions about whether or not Craig Bounds was going to continue to work, at when he was going to retire had he not been injured, whether he was going to, going forward in the future, earn another job, have another job where he would earn some money. In other words, there were various scenarios, and actually four different tables, and they're all in evidence. And they range from a range of about, and I'm guessing now, but I know the top range is well over $600,000. And that was a range. I asked him, which one do you think is the most likely? And he had the range of two to three or something like that. But I mean, the jury wasn't bound by that. I argued and did argue and point out to the jury that, you know, Dr. Minahan used very conservative discount factors. I mean, you know, he admitted that it was, so there was no reason, and that got you to above 600. So to say, no, the most the jury could have concluded is 200,000 is bogus. Now, Judge Vaughn referred to 200,000 in his footnote in the opinion. Why, I don't know. But, I mean, it certainly wasn't a determination that 200,000 was the maximum, because the jury had this spectrum of tables in front of them, and they could seize any one based on their factual findings about the validity of the underlying assumptions.
All right, so the $600,000 figure is within the matrix of or range that Minahan testified.
Oh, that's one of the numbers on this table. I mean, it was there. I have a little bit. Is there something that you'd particularly like to hear me talk about? Because I have about five other points, and I'll just take them in my order. The lien issue. This was a problem of DP&L's own making. They could have brought GEICO in. Now we know they elected not to do it. They've been discussing it with GEICO and CNA. They filed a separate action against GEICO in Newcastle County dealing with the same very contract that they were trying to get Judge Vaughn to adjudicate. Of course, they didn't tell us about that. And at the same time, they were trying to get Judge Vaughn to rule that the lien had been invalidated pursuant to this contract they were suing on secretly in Newcastle County. Judge Vaughn said, I can't do that. GEICO and CNA are not parties. You're welcome to come in after verdict, and if you want to do that, then we can have further proceedings. They haven't done that. What they've done, as I say, they've gone into Newcastle County. We know that they, in that lawsuit, they said that, in the footnote, Judge Carpenter says that they said apparently in that brief that the reason they didn't bring in GEICO was a tactical one, and it wouldn't be a tactical one, because if they had brought in GEICO, they'd be attacking themselves, in essence, and so they made a tactical decision not to do it. But they, at the same time, they're trying to have Judge Vaughn make that decision in a time when they are not parties, so Bounds could have ended up winning, getting a lesser verdict, and then still have to repay it, the lien out of the lesser verdict. That's just not fair. So far as a superseding cause, if DPNL's position was the law of this state, it would mean that in every work-related tort personal injury case, there'd always be a trial within a trial. You would have to have, the plaintiff would have to show he mitigated his damages, which we had to do. He'd also have to show that the comp carrier, over which he has no control, and with which he is in an adversarial position, also performed properly. He'd probably have to have a expert witness come in and say, what is the standard of care? When can a comp carrier legitimately refuse to make a payment? And finally, most importantly, you'd have a comp carrier as a party in every case, which is prohibited by the third party statute, 19 Delaware Code, section 2363, which specifically says you don't name the comp carrier. As a factual matter, they didn't show anything. About 2 weeks before the trial, they took an 11-page deposition from a retired CNA claims agent. And I, if you have any question about this, I ask you to read it. It's at B48. She didn't know anything. She had no knowledge as to what they did. The jury had no evidence as to whether, even what CNA did, not let alone whether or not it was proper or improper. And finally, as Judge Vaughn says, there's just no authority that would allow that, no Delaware case law that would allow that to go forward. Well, we dealt with the size of the verdict. In getting ready for the argument, I saw there's one point I didn't cover. Page 23 of their brief, they complain about a statement that I made in closing about the cost of modifying the drain cap. That's at A369. What I was talking about was not modifying the drain cap after the fall. What had happened, what developed was, this drain cap screwed out. And somehow over the years, and then it would screw back in and be flush. Somehow over the years, it became cross-threaded. So they braved, according to their 30B6 witness, a 1/2-inch plate over it. And that's what created the tripping hazard. And I was telling the jury, you know, that's what caused the problem. They should have fixed it in the first place, and it wouldn't have happened. And I conclude that by saying, quote, that is what happened, and that is what caused Craig Bounds to fall. I'm not arguing about 407 issues or modification. I'm talking about why the problem was there in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Abbott.
I see. Thank you.
Very briefly, with regard to the your Honor's issue, Lacey versus Beck talks about the court, and in that case it was a trial court, but that's a decision that's been recognized by this court and approved in later cases, which is cited in our reply brief, Your Honor. They specifically say that one of the things to look at is consistency with recent verdicts.
But does that mandate it, or is that simply permissive?
I think it's part of the, I don't know that it absolutely mandates it, but if you look at Stewart versus Genesco, there is an objective requirement put on as to what the maximum of what a reasonable jury could consider, and that is one of the ways to allow the court to do that.
That's different conceptually from a mandated obligation to consider verdicts in other cases.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm not going to say that that's the case. I think it's part of the mix that the court has to look at, and if this court looks at what the trial judges have done, they've repeatedly looked at other verdicts as part of the mix that goes on, and I think that's part of the examination that's necessary in order to exercise their discretion. With regard to the, Justice Holland, your question concerning the representations that were made at oral argument, There is a transcript of the oral argument that was made on, I believe, May 12th on the subsequent remedial measures, where we specifically offered to take whatever action was necessary in order to, you know, comply with what we were seeking, which was the bar of the 407 as to any subsequent remedial measures. I may not have said it exactly as Your Honor posited, but we, for example, offered to withdraw any photographs, to put only a two-dimensional picture in, and certainly if Judge Vaughn ruled in our favor, we would have followed the court's requirements with regard to that, would not have gone back to something that would even touch on modification.
Is that in the appendix somewhere?
I could not find it just now. That's why I wanted to make sure the court was aware of the citation.
Thank you very much.
My time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you both. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement and we'll also take a brief recess.
Please rise.